Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Grace. Now, as Grace says, I do spend a fair amount of time talking to groups about child abuse. It's what I do every day of the working week. I have, however, never talked or delivered anything about child abuse with children in the room. And that's slightly disconcerting to me. Now, as the last speaker, I would very much like to think that I could leave you with happy thoughts, positive feelings. Not sure I can do that, given the Defence Against the Dark Arts topic. But what I hope that we actually all can leave you with is some sense of empowerment. Some sense that you can play a part in making a difference in these kids' lives. You've got a role to play. And maybe a little less anxiety and fear around this topic. Now, Protega Maxima, that was the magical shield spell that was cast over Hogwarts to protect Harry and the other students from the Death Eaters and the Dementors. What's the magical shield for abused kids? Is there one? Now, what I've been asked to speak to you about is what happens next for children after a report to Child Protection is made? And the simple answer to that is just a whole set of decisions. Child Protection need to make decisions. They need to make decisions about placements, about supports, about other kids, about the length of time they'll be involved, about the need for children's court. The police need to make decisions. Are there charges to be laid? What charges are we going to lay? Who are we going to lay them against? And we can, I think, form maybe a piece of the puzzle that needs to be built up around these kids in order that those decisions are the right decisions. Now, this work isn't easy, and I do it every day of the week. You need to be prepared to be criticised, to be scrutinised. You need to be prepared to be questioned. And I think it almost feels sometimes that you need to sort of don this psychological suit of armour and into battle you go. And I think that takes some bravery. And in fact, I don't know how many of you were at the psychiatry concurrent session just before lunch when they were talking about the trouble, the sort of psychological trouble that doctors are in, the high suicide rates, the high rates of mental health difficulties, and especially among paediatrics. And I thought, oh, crikey, you know, I really am in trouble. But I think you do actually need to be brave, and you need to be brave when it's the right time to be brave. You also need to be cautious. And as Bindu alluded to, this is not a time for guesswork. This is really not a time for subjective opinions. This is a time to get it right. And I'd like you to meet Hermione. Obviously not a real name, but this is real photographs. Hermione was 17 months old, and she presented to ED on one of those really busy Saturday afternoons, which almost all of you will be very, very familiar with. She came with her dad. And these photos of Hermione were taken a couple of days after she presented, for reasons, good reasons at the time. And what you can see Hermione has is she has bruises to both of her cheeks. She has a bruise to her right temple. She has multiple abrasions, two of which are symmetrical and patterned. She had a markedly swollen nose, which was clinically thought to be broken. She had a right subgaleal hemorrhage. She had two right-sided parietal skull fractures. She had lacerations to the inner surfaces, the mucosa of both her upper and lower lips. And she had a fully healed right clavicle fracture. But what struck everybody who met Hermione most were not these physical injuries. What struck me the most, what struck the ED doctors the most, what struck the nurses who were looking after her the most, what struck the radiographer who did her bone scan, what struck the photographer who took these photos, was the way Hermione was. Now, all of us have examined 17-month-old children, and we all know what it's like. At very best, they're suspicious. They look at you, they sort of put their head in their mum's arm, they look at you out of the corner of their eye. When the stethoscope comes, they sort of start to push you away, they may start to whinge, they may start to cry. When you get to the ENT exam, then it's just restraint. It's the only way forward. Not Hermione. Hermione lay still, on her back, on the examining couch in ED. Parents were in the room, but over the other side of the room. When you took her, she had a very, very tight, very dirty, very bloodstained singlet on. When you took that off over this really swollen nose, it impacted the nose, maybe a single tear. No noise. When I examined her mouth, nothing. When both her parents were arrested in the emergency department and removed, Hermione didn't turn. She didn't look back. She didn't put her arms out. She didn't cry. She didn't ask for her mum. She was happy to be carried by me, by the nursing staff, by the ward clerks. So the report of child protection was put in. Absolutely appropriately, it was put in. What happens next? It's the beginning of a journey for Hermione. Her physical injuries will heal. They may not even constitute the definition of serious injury legally. They'll heal. But they are important. And they're important because they are the cardinal feature that says Hermione's in trouble. Hermione needs protection. And what we need to do is we need to recognize those injuries, and we need to provide a report that correctly interprets those injuries in the context of Hermione. And we need to provide an opinion that is objective and evidence-based about those injuries. And for Hermione, she starts a journey of processes and placements, of contact visits and reunification attempts, of successes, of failures. And what we need to do is make sure the right decisions are made for Hermione at the right times. And Bindu's talked about this. What do we need to do? Well, the first thing we need to do is open our minds. We need to be open to the possibility of abuse always, and it's commoner than I bet all of you think it is. But you also need to open your mind to considering all alternative possibilities, however unlikely or implausible they may seem. Could this child have osteogenesis imperfecta? Could this child have Ehlers-Danlos? You need to be objective. You need to be fair. So you need to treat the 19-year-old single mum methamphetamine user the same as the nuclear family from the right side of town, and that is crucial in my mind. And you need to be evidence-based. Your report or your opinion needs to stand up to scrutiny, and that scrutiny may be in the witness stand. An example that I think we often see of what I would call rather loose language in this area is, the fracture was consistent with the fall. Okay, good, great, done a job, go home. Except there is one huge gap in that statement. And that's, what else could that fracture be consistent with? Could the fracture be consistent with a kick to the thigh? Could the fracture be consistent with being thrown against the wall? Could the fracture be consistent with a forceful twist? How are we going to sort that out? Well, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to conduct a thorough assessment, and we're going to be aware that we are a part, just a part, a piece of the puzzle. We're not the whole. You're going to take a history, and you're going to take a history that is excruciatingly detailed. It's not they fell off the couch. It's, what was the couch made of? How high was the couch? What was the child doing immediately before they fell? Were they running across the couch? Were they climbing over the back? Were they sitting quietly? What's the surface on which they impacted? There's a very, very big difference between carpet with underlay and tiles. Was there anything else where they impacted? Was there toys there? Was there an edge of a fireplace, for example? What part of their body impacted first, and what did they do immediately after and for the ensuing hours after the fall? Family history, a couple of generations back, again, OI, genetic conditions, stillbirths, anything that could be associated with this condition, however rare that may be. You examine the child, you carefully document injuries. Bindu's talked about that. Photography is crucial. And then investigations. Now, we do sometimes ask for some really quite weird blood tests and things, and I think the Gen Med team sort of think, what the heck? Are they asking for this? Coppers and all sorts of funny things. And then there's radiology. And I have heard, less so now, but certainly that sort of thing, well, look, are you sure you want to irradiate this child? They look very well. This is radiation we're talking about. And what I say to that is that failure to identify that occult bony injury, failure to identify that thin-layed subdural, is failing in our duty as advocates for these children. And that failure allows that child to perhaps go home to a household where the abuse will continue and they may be killed. And it allows quite significant psychosocial morbidity to develop and possibly in the intergenerational effects of abuse that we're also aware of. And I think that there are very, very many conditions that we irradiate children for which have far less impact and psychosocial morbidity than child abuse. You gather information from all sources. We go on a huge information gathering exercise in VFPMS. We ring school teachers, maternal and child health nurses, kindergarten teachers, anyone we can think of, to try and build up a picture of this child's life. And then, as I say, we consider all possibilities. And in our reports, we need to be explicit about how we have excluded those possibilities, if we can. And then you come up with a conclusion. And that may be that this injury pattern is highly concerning for inflicted injury. We may say the story provided by the carer of the fall is likely to explain the fracture. Or we may say we simply cannot determine. And all of those are okay, provided they're right. Now, we also need to acknowledge missing pieces. What about Hermione? So we look at Hermione and we say, yeah, that's abuse. She looks like she's been, you know, four rounds in the ring with Mike Tyson. That's abuse. But if we were told that she'd been in a motor vehicle accident, lots of soft tissue injuries, a couple of parietal fractures of her skull, it's fine. What if we were told she'd been on the monkey bars and she'd fallen, impacted her head one side as she went down on the bars, other side onto tan bark? Can you stand in a witness stand and say that's impossible? Don't think you can. What if they said, well, actually, we didn't see anything, but she was out in the backyard, and there was these two older kids from down the road that come and play with her, and they aren't very nice, and there was a dog out there. They must have knocked her over a couple of times. Can you say that's impossible? I don't think I can. The missing pieces with Hermione was there was no story. There was a complete lack of any story. She must have just woken up like that. Coupled with her markedly abnormal emotional state, which we, as paediatricians, GPs, ED doctors, are so well placed to comment on. Now, abused children don't do well. We all know that they have poor outcomes in all domains. Their mental and physical health, their development, their educational attainment, their peer relationships. The first 3 years of life is really crucial to the way that your brain develops. And children who are brought up in violent households, the centres of their brain, or the areas of their brain that respond to violence, that respond to aggression, develop faster. The synapses connect quicker. The myelination happens quicker. Whereas the sides of their brain, or the areas of their brain that respond to nurturing and to love, don't develop in the same way. So they adapt to the environment in which they are living, as all animals do. However, when they again go out into the big wide world, into kinder, into school, they are maladapted to that environment. So they respond more quickly to facial signals that might suggest aggression. They kick, they spit, they hit. That's what they're used to doing. They can't concentrate in class. They're hypervigilant. There's a noise. What's going to happen when I go home? So we need to, I think, use words that count. I think we need to write reports that carry impact, that are explicit, but that are 100% right 100% of the time. And we can make a difference. A few weeks ago, I spent a day and a half, as did my neuropathology colleague and my ophthalmology colleague, in the witness stand at the Supreme Court in Victoria, where this man, Joby Rowe, was found guilty of the child homicide of his infant daughter, Alana, who presented a couple of years before with subdural hemorrhages, retinal hemorrhages, and severe brain swelling, what is colloquially known as the triad, indicating violent shaking. Now, to our knowledge, that's the first successful conviction for a triad-only case in Victoria. And I think it came about as the result of rigorous examination of the medical evidence, which actually could stand up to that scrutiny. And obviously, it doesn't always have to be this dramatic, but it's still important. And Hermani? Well, Hermani was removed from the violence. And within a few days on the ward, she started to talk. Within a few weeks, she started to demonstrate significant attachment to significant figures. She started to smile, and she started to laugh. But her journey is not over. Child protection are still making decisions about Hermani. Police are still making decisions about who to charge and what with. I'm still writing addendums. We have yet to take the witness stand. And Hermani is still learning. She's still learning, and she's still growing, and she's still developing. And I think that what we want for Hermani is for her to learn about a world where there is no violence, about a world where there's no fear and no pain. And when you ask adult survivors of childhood abuse, what did you want to happen at the time? They say, I didn't necessarily want to lose my family. I just wanted the abuse to stop. They wanted people to see the abuse. They wanted people to care about the abuse. And they wanted people to stop the abuse. So thank you for listening.
Fantastic talk, Jo. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to clarify something for some people in the audience. In terms of the photographs with Hermione, restrictions on...
Yes. So I've asked for those. Although this talk, I think, can be shared, the photographs can't. Mm-hmm. I have signed permission to use those for teaching, so I'm happy to use them. But obviously, the rules of confidentiality apply, and that is a real child. I can't share the photographs.
So any thoughts from Twitter?
There are no questions from Twitter. I think that the combination of these three talks have left us with loads to think about and some words to take home. A lot of appreciation for sharing your expertise. Maybe we can open it up again to the audience if there's any questions.
I guess, yes, over there.
Jo.
Oh, hello.
How much do you think it makes a difference taking the stand as a medical expert compared to just writing a report?
Look, I think as a medical expert, taking the stand is really... it's really important, it's really influential. It depends in what environment. In the children's court, a lot of these cases are run by child protection, and they do a fabulous job. But they will often say to us, look, we're going to call you because the judges or the magistrates will listen to a medical person. I don't always know that that's entirely justified, but I think it is. I do think, and what I've learned through doing this job, is that it's a real responsibility to take that stand. It's not something you should do lightly, and I'm sure nobody would, but I think I've learned as the years have gone by how important it is to stick to what you know and not to make any other assumptions. You're not there, you're not on that witness stand for that child, actually. You're there for the court, and you're there to provide information to the court, who then makes the decision. It's not you up there who's trying to make a decision for this child. So I think you have to be clear why you're there and stick to evidence and stick to objective facts. And then I think you actually make more difference than if you try to become too emotive. And I think judges and magistrates don't like that. So yeah, it is. If you write a really good report, sometimes it can mean that you don't have to go to court, but not always.
I'll just speak loudly. Thanks very much to all the speakers. Joe, you mentioned with the conviction with this Joby Rowe, mm-hmm. that it was unprecedented and that it was because the
I think there's so much perceived controversy around this thing, the triad. People think, this really doesn't exist, you know, and I think that there is an increasing recognition that controversy actually isn't a medical controversy, it's a legal controversy. And so I think it was being absolutely clear about the evidence base and about trying to really make it clear to the jury that this isn't a real controversy, that most practicing doctors think that this is a real thing, and then making the jury understand. So what your job is that when you're on the stand is to take the question, to interpret the question, to figure out how best to answer that, which is not going to tie you up into, you know, dig you massive holes, but also to then relay that to a jury of lay people such that they understand it. And that can be tricky, but I think it's to do with reverting to the evidence. I think it's the expert witnesses that appeared were all very objective. They didn't try and go off their area of expertise. I think it's to do with probably the quality of the way the evidence was presented. I don't know. But yes, I don't think we have had a successful condition for triad only, because there's no objective evidence of trauma, and that's what the jury struggle with.
I found that one of the challenges with child protection is at the back of people's minds, they're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to be the witness stand being cross-examined. Mm. But really, there's no difference between this process and what we do every single day in medicine. Mm. Take a good history, take a thorough history, do a good examination, keep that in mind, come to a diagnostic formulation, do the right
absolutely.
Tests,
absolutely.
Come to diagnosis.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I just think that, I suppose, that one of the things I would emphasise is, although this talk is the dark arts, it's actually not a different parallel universe.
No.
It's the same thing.
Absolutely it is, and we spent a lot of time actually in that case talking about the way doctors make diagnoses and that this is actually no different when you diagnose an infant as having the triad.
And the only other thing, too, I reckon what's really important is this is the opportunity to save the child's life. It might be the single opportunity to save a child's life.
Yes.
Or to save the brain.
Yes.
We might take a question from the left over here, I believe.
I just have a question around kind of, obviously these injuries are quite upsetting. I remember, like, as a junior doctor seeing my first kind of non-aspect severe case and just that kind of emotional trauma you experienced. So, probably quite well, it's a question related to all three, but just kind of any strategies you have in terms of like team debriefing or how you kind of manage that own emotional response, or your team's emotional. I find it quite, like, as a senior now, really quite challenging. You know, juniors will come to you, the nurses get worked up. Mm. How do you kind of turn that down?
Yeah, you're absolutely. I mean, she caused an awful lot of distress and upset in ED. The simple answer, I think, is that we don't have a good enough response to that. Certainly within VFPMS, I don't believe we do have a good enough response. We rely very much on the doctors being tough enough, I think. And I think that's why the talk prior to lunch that I heard really struck me, and I think we are... There's greater recognition, I think, within forensic paediatrics that this needs to be better done. So I don't have an answer to you. I don't know what we do. We do have a small team, and the majority of our team, we do talk between us, and I think that is probably, for me, the biggest support. But I think it probably should be done more formally and better. And certainly when you get a child who presents to ED, that does cause an awful lot of distress. A bit for us, we're at fault in that we'll kind of say, oh, well, I mean, that's just the same as we had yesterday or the day before. But for those staff in ED, it is different, and we're probably not good enough at recognising and responding to that.
Just a quick one about, we've spoken about documenting very objectively, and that's straightforward in terms of injuries, but for that other piece about the interaction between the parent and the child, the state of the child, the baby grows dirty.
Yes, yes. Objective facts, so the singlet's dirty, it's bloodstained, objective. I think I very rarely make statements in my reports about a mother-child interaction, I don't, or about a way a child behaves, because they're in an unusual environment. It's difficult to be objective. However, in her case, it was so abnormal that I was very happy to say, and it was commented on by the ENT team, the neurosurgeons, everybody who saw her, they would write a comment, easy to examine, extremely passive. And I think that's when you have to come back. You have to be clear that if you could stand in the witness stand and say, as a paediatrician, I've seen, you know, hundreds or thousands of children, they don't behave like this, then you can make a comment on it. But I would steer away from making comments if it's just a little bit, because your subjectivity and your cognitive bias can come into play, but not with her. It was so abnormal.
Does it make a difference which court you go to, whether it's coroner's versus the court of criminal court?
In terms of
your role and the way you are...
Probably just a bit to the amount of stress you feel. children's court tends to be much more chaotic. You often don't go. It's all a bit over the place. And probably the level of scrutiny you're under is less. The criminal courts, you're talking about beyond reasonable doubt. You're talking about serious criminal charges. You're talking about jail sentences, sometimes long jail sentences. So I just feel that the onus on you, it's always to get it right, but it's just that slightly increased level of pressure, I guess. But not hugely.
Do you recommend getting your own legal advice before you
give evidence? No, we don't. What I do recommend is talking to somebody who's used to giving evidence, who knows how to give evidence. There is a skill. And we always say with our fellows or trainees, and we offer it to staff at the Royal Children's Hospital to come, if they're asked to call to give evidence, that they can come and chat with us about how you can do that and some of the common pitfalls.
Thank you for that. I would get some GP, ED, Reg, in a very smallish town where everyone tends to know each other. What do you do if someone comes into your child, like this comes into your ED and you're concerned, but you know the mum because she's a nurse that works in
yep.
Mm-hmm. And everyone in the ED knows
mm-hmm.
them. Is there anyone we can refer to or call that come and make those objective statements? Because I assume that if I know the mum and I give evidence, that evidence won't be taken as...
I don't know. I don't think that's true. You're assessing that child in your professional role, not as a friend or colleague even of that child's family. And that's what you have to stick to. And that's why I say... You know, we're in this area of work, it's very high risk, and you're under a lot of scrutiny. So that's why I say you have to revert back to objectivity. I think in that situation, what you're really saying is you've got to be sure, because it's even worse. You know, you've got this person that you may know. And so I would say, well, if you need help in interpreting those injuries in the context of possible inflicted injury, then get advice. Because you're put into a worse situation if you get that wrong. It's even worse. It depends. In Victoria, it would be us, so the VFPMS. So we're statewide. So we will give advice to anybody within the state of Victoria. So it's just a phone call.
My question relates to something that Nikki said at the start, which was that there's that issue of potentially devastating effects of referring to DHS when there's no issue. But my question would be, given that we can never be 100% right, don't have 100% specific tests that we do.
Yep.
If we do decide to make that referral, what? My question is to Joe as well, actually. What communications can we do to minimise those effects? How do we? It's not something that I often would do in my job. What advice would you give to minimise those effects? At that point where you start, obviously, would be a very important interaction.
Look, I think it's honesty, transparency. I think it's also being clear what role child protection plays. I think there's a misperception that child protection is simply there to come and take your kids away. And that's the fear that families have. And I think it's sitting down with them. I mean, I'm a big one for openness and honesty and saying, look, this is what we're going to have to do. We've got some concerns here. I think an important thing to get across is you're not the one who's pointing any fingers. It's nothing to do with you. Who is doing this? It's you, your child focused. It's to do with the child. You've got concerns about the child. You've got concerns about the injury. You are mandated, and we often say to people who call us, revert to the mandatory laws. You're mandated to report this. And then I would recommend having a conversation with the family about the role of child protection and what child protection does and what child protection can offer. Now, child protection is widely perceived as negative. But I don't think that's always the case. They're taking children away as the last resort. They're not going to do that easily. It's to do with putting supports into this family. And that's where I take it with families. I say, look, it will be stressful. You know, I'm not going to lie to you. It's a stressful thing to go through, but it can have positive outcomes. And that's all I would say is that we have these conversations on a daily basis with families. It doesn't always work, and it doesn't always go well at all. But I think it's being honest. You know, and I think they will come back at you, and many times they do, you know. But if you have been honest from the beginning, it's all you can do. It's an area that nobody's going to like you. You're not going to make friends. It doesn't always go well. But that's all I can say. Honesty, transparency, and the role of child protection can have positive outcomes. They put a heap of supports into these families sometimes.
Any more questions for any of the speakers?
The that the prosecutors had said was following up to say, have you contacted to find out how this kid has gone, or what they're doing now, or where are they? And I said, no, I haven't. And they were happy with that. Mm-hmm. Something that I hadn't actually contemplated before, that can be seen in an adverse way by the court. They were interpreted in an adverse manner by the court.
As in that you were too invested in that family, yeah.
And you've come to your own conclusion.
Yeah, yeah, and that's true. So you have to be able to revert to your professional role. So if your professional opinion was that that child needed follow-up, that's what you do. But if that wasn't the case or wasn't the need, then you don't do it. So it's all about being able to defend your actions as being what you would reasonably do. But yeah, it can be, because you mustn't be seen to be biased in the court or entrenched or in one camp. You've got to be totally objective and there just to... all you're doing is informing the court. You're just letting them know the facts. They are the trier of facts. They're the decision makers.
I had a question, which is that you discussed the importance of treating the 19-year-old drug-addicted mother the same as, you know, the nuclear family from the right side of town. And Bindu, you also, and Nikki, you both also alluded to it. How do each of you think about how to rein back those cognitive biases and sort of examine it with a fresh pair of eyes?
I think it's just sticking to those objectivity. You just look at the injury and you don't... You're going to interpret the injuries in the context of the story given to you, but not in the context, I don't believe, of the social background. It's important. It's something that needs to be... Information needs to be gathered, and it's something that child protection will use, but I don't think is our role. As forensic paediatricians, it's certainly not our role to interpret psychosocial factors in terms of the story. I think we have to stick to objectivity.
Maybe one last question.
I've certainly been directly threatened by families in this situation. Has that ever happened to you, and how do you manage it?
Do you know, surprisingly little. It's amazing, I think. Amazing that the code greys, you know, the security codes, you hear them all throughout the hospital. They're very rarely for us. I don't know whether any of us have been... I mean, look, we've been sworn at and, you know, the normal things. You know, there's a good deal of effing and blinding going on and what the hell do you think and stuff. But no, I haven't been directly physically threatened. There's been passive-aggressive behaviour and there's been subsequent complaints, which are unpleasant. But as for direct physical threats, I haven't had a real physical one. Yeah, it's different.
How do you cope if you have been physically threatened? What's your response?
It's nothing clever. Like, it's basically just removing myself and actually trying to predict where somebody might kick off. And also just you know, making sure that you're at the edge of a cubicle, you don't go right into the cubicle, and that if you're going to have a difficult conversation with a volatile person, that you don't go on your own. Common sense stuff, but yeah.
Most of the problems have been when child protection have actually attended to take the children away, to remove the children. That's when, in our experience, that's when it really kicks off, more than when we do the assessment. It's when actually the kids are going to be removed, which is understandable.
But I'd really echo Jo and say it's very, very rare.
It is actually, very surprisingly rare. I'm waiting for it. I'm sure it'll happen.
Well, thank you so much, Nikki, Bindu, and Jo. Fantastic talk.